Thank you, Audrey. That was very interesting. But at my age, you often think of retirement. But given the challenges that you've just talked about, I think I've got plenty of years left of exciting work ahead of us. So we're now entering into a question and answers for Audrey. We've got about 20 minutes. I thought I'd start off by asking, at one point you talked about empowering the consumers and you also mentioned a high uptake of solar rooftop PV in Western Australia. I've noticed in a feed yesterday that there was increasing interest in establishment of microgrids where there's a little trading hub in certain areas. And even yesterday, as I said, there was an announcement about a new peer-to-peer trading platform around this. So I was wondering what your thoughts are on mini-grids working within the system or, you know, alongside the system.
Sure. So I think that, you know, microgrids, particularly ones that remain interconnected to the system, and there are different types of microgrids, like everything in this industry. You know, smart grid has become a meaningless term because people applied it to everything. But to me, the concept of a microgrid is a system that can operate independent of the grid for some time. And there are both connected and unconnected microgrids. So a connected microgrid, in my view, would be one that's sort of connected to the big grid and actually can provide services to the big grid when that's needed and can operate in isolation when that's needed and can be of great deal of value, particularly in areas where you might have weakness at the edge of the system or in isolated areas. So, for example, I worked on a microgrid early on that was at San Diego Electric, at the University of San Diego, which was at the edge of a system. And there were times when the university was actually able to support the big grid in an efficient way. So I think that's a great deal of value. And, you know, and then peer-to-peer training as well. I mean, one of the terms that, you know, I think we need to start introducing into our vernacular is this concept of the energy democracy, because that's really what's happening. You know, people have, can make individual decisions, and our job is really to enable that individual decision and use it to the advantage of everyone else, and that's where this networking concept comes through. If you could do peer-to-peer trading, do it to a signal, help it support the system security, and help people feel that the, you know, people who want to engage in it have the ability to control their price, you have that win-win-win solution, which really technology and digitalization allows us to do, and what we in the industry should, and we at AEMO are looking for ways to facilitate.
Thank you. Questions from the floor. We've got one down the end there. Could you please state your name and affiliation, please?
Sure. Liz Aitken from Perth Energy. Thank you for coming over, Audrey. Much appreciated. I just wanted to ask, of all of the huge suite of things that has to be achieved here in the WEM, what would you consider to be the most urgent and important?
Well, I think there's not a single thing. I think there are multiple things that are urgent and important. We have to start addressing the issue of the constraints on the transmission system because it's a very challenging thing to manage. We have to start thinking about how we're going to use DER to distributed resources, rooftop solar, to our advantage. We have to think about how we're going to be able to use storage to our advantage. So I don't think any of these could be saying, well, let's do this in sequence. Unfortunately, when you look at a pace of change like we're looking at, we do need to do some what we would call parallel processing. We have to advance a number of different things to make sure we're working together, and we need to think about how they relate. I mean, fundamentally, I would say is this. Look, you know, we could just use the words, but this is a very complex and it is a very unprecedented change in this industry, and it requires clear-headed thinking with a clear destination and a willingness to work together to get there. And one of the worst things that is happening, I think, in Australia is the amount of dissension and fighting we see in the NEM. It's hurting everyone and hurting customers. And what I'm hoping is in WA we could show how we can crack on and get on with it and show that actually this is not a red or blue issue. This is about individual consumers and taking advantage of technological change and advancing that for the benefit of consumers, both in the short term and the long term, and not trying to really piecemeal it to say, well, if we do this, then we're done. We won't be done for a while, and we just need to think about all the things we have to do and then move on.
Are there any other questions? One down the middle there. While the microphone's been taken to this person.
Hi.
Sorry.
Ray Wills, here with Horizon Power today. I'm a board member. One of the things that is you've highlighted is the rate of change. We know globally the International Energy Agency, the Energy Information Administration in the US have always got this stuff wrong. I don't know Australia's actually any different, really, with this disruptive change has always come faster than we think. And one of the challenges with things coming faster is there's always exits as well. And you've highlighted coal-fired power stations perhaps not continuing on. So I guess the challenge from your point of view as the operator is how do you plan for that rate of change, particularly when the policy wonks like me are out there saying it's going to be really fast and there's other policy wonks equally opposed to me who are saying you're wrong. But the evidence is I'm not. The evidence is you're not in your statement. How do we actually plan for that change?
What did you say about the WEM not having diverse views?
I think what we have to do, and again, I'll come back to the actions that we're seeing. We have to plan for it being faster. We can't, we can't hope that it happens a certain way. We have to plan for it being faster and then being able to adjust to go slower if we have to. And so thinking about how we're going to address the system security issues when we have high levels of rooftop solar is something we have to do now, and that's why the DER roadmap is going to be very important. And, you know, I think that we should take counsel of what we saw in solar and wind. The fact is that people are seeing prices now that nobody expected to see until 2030. And it keeps going down. I think batteries are going to go the same route. It's, you know, we're saying now they're still too expensive, but you know, we can't discount the amount of research and work that's going on in various battery companies to drive down the cost of batteries and make them better. So all that's going to happen, I think, quicker than we think in the industry, and that is really and then the last thing is consumers have changed. And quite frankly, you know, I sit around the room, and for those of us who, you know, may be on the other side of 50, you know, we recognize we're not the target market anymore. And our kids who are starting to make decisions are making very different decisions and think about technology differently than we did. And they want that autonomy. And they worry about the environment. So it's going to change much faster, and we as a system have to be prepared for it.
If my experience is any guide, I think we're the target market for our kids too. Yeah. Any other questions? Right at the back.
Thanks. Matt McKenzie from Business News. I think you've got a very tough job, and I really appreciate you coming out to Perth to have a chat to us this morning. Last year, the ACCC's review of the national energy market said there should be a cap on generating power. And I'm just curious if you think something like that should apply in WA. Are you concerned about the level of market concentration in generation capacity?
Certainly, you know, something, AEMO is the market operator. We're not a regulator. So that is not something we get engaged in. What I do think, however, again, if we can create this two-way power system, particularly because the WEM is an energy island, you're going to have more competition, because the best thing to cap anyone's prices is when an individual consumer says, well, I'm only going to buy as much as I really need and is economic for me, and I have that ability because I can put solar on my roof. And so I think actually making an animated demand market will help us manage the productivity of the system and send a very clear signal to generators as to what price people are willing to buy at. And I think that will help a lot.
Thank you. Thank you. There's another question on the front here.
Peter Leonard from Carnarvon Petroleum. Terrific address this morning. Thank you very much. But one of the things that exercises my mind is that it seems that we've got a very dramatic pace of technological change taking place, and the economics are changing equally rapidly, and I think economics are driving the change very much as well. But at the same time, we've got to overlay this with a regulatory environment, and so it seems that one of the problems is that perhaps the regulatory environment's not keeping pace with the rate of the other changes taking place.
You know, I had an opportunity last year to address a group in called the SEGRE, which is the International Engineering Group, and it was their national meeting, and it was people from all over the world. And I gave an address where I talked about one of the critical features we have to address is around adaptive regulation. And even though people spoke many different languages and came from different regulatory environments, that was the one thing that resonated with everyone, is that we've built our regulatory environments around a certain sort of construct in our mind of companies that change slowly, investments that last a long time, things like that. And that's the thing we saw in New York. We had to change the regulatory environment. So the fact of the matter is, and this is, you know, I think for most people here in business, as you know, think about what Shell's doing. Here's Shell getting involved in renewables. If someone told someone in Shell that was going to be their future 10, 20 years ago, they said, no, we're not in renewables. We're in gas and oil. I think about GE. You know, this is a company that a huge portion of their revenues came from building big stationary power plants. They've had to change and rebrand themselves and are thinking about becoming a digital company. One of the challenges I had as a regulator was to recognize that part of my job as a regulator had to be to enable the businesses I oversaw to adapt to change. Because if you can't change your business model, you're going to die. And so we need to think about the fact that every component of the industry might have been designed around a certain construct. For example, you know, the wires companies, we think of them as just wires companies, just putting up wires, when frankly, when you have people putting solar on their roofs, there are services that maybe they should be supplying, because those are the kinds of services their new customers need. So when you think about, you know, what various entities should do, and one of the things about how regulation, I think, could be very useful is encouraging companies to be the best, not at what they did historically, but what they could be in the future, and enabling them to make those changes. Because one thing that I, you know, as a regulator and then also an executive in a regulated company, when 90% of your revenues come from a regulator, you pay a lot of attention to what they say. And if a regulator says, I want you to change, I don't want you to stay the same, it's amazing how changes can make. So yes, I think we have to think about the regulatory constructs to be one that really is pushed towards driving innovation, even at older companies, not just the new ones.
Just on that, I've been amazed at how you're talking about small-scale uptake, but there's also been a large uptake of large utility-scale projects, and much more than what we need for meeting the LRET target or any other government scheme. I'm wondering whether the developers of these projects, and every week we get people coming to us to do technical due diligence studies for projects that we haven't even heard of. I wonder if they understand what the changes are likely to be and how that will affect their operations, because I get the impression that they're not on top of it.
I think what's happening is, just as you know everything else, so some of the new developers, the pace of change and how radical things have changed was they're beginning to recognize that pace. So we see this in the both on the East Coast, probably not as much here as on the West Coast, but we see a lot of it. And I think it is, how do we get transparency and knowledge, because we have folks coming in who think, you know, they're entering into this industry for the first time and maybe don't appreciate the complexity of the power system and are making some mistakes that are costing a lot of money. One thing that AEMO's working on is a project that I'm really hoping we can get off is we're working with the CSIRO and want to develop what we're calling a digital twin of the energy systems, not just the power system, but the power and gas system. The idea is this. If you create a digital twin, what it would be is actually a live system of the NEM that people could actually use to create transparency, so that what we could do is actually, when someone's trying to make a big bet on a 300 megawatt wind farm, actually show them where they're locating it, what the flows are going to look like, what the costs are going to look like, so they can make a much more intelligent investment decision. Because this is all about transparency. And when I think about, you know, how is this going to work and how do we create confidence, it's all around making information as transparent as possible and giving people the ability to see it. Because that's always been the, you know, challenge in this energy industry, like most monopolies, is information asymmetry. Well, AEMO is an independent operator. Our goal is really to be as transparent as we can so that we can gain the knowledge and people can actually see it, both from a policymaker decision, an investment decision, a resource decision. So by using technology to create this digital twin of our power system, it's going to help my operators be able to make quicker decisions. But it'll also be able to help the rest of the industry, so as they're making decisions, they understand the implications and therefore can take the right types of actions that protect their interests.
Thank you. I only discovered what a digital twin was last week. So, question down the back.
Hello, Fabian Legay-Brereton from ERM Power. You talked about the importance of making things simple for the customer. How do we reconcile that with, you know, an energy system and energy markets that are becoming even more complex? Does that necessarily mean we're going to have more complex products and customers are going to have to adapt to that?
I think that the job of anyone in business is to meet the needs of the customer. So, you know, this debate I used to have... I was really criticized because I was not interested in putting time-of-use pricing in New York. And the reason I wasn't is that I just saw that for people, a lot of people in New York, it would be very confusing, very anxiety, and I didn't, you know, particularly with folks who are low-income and stay-at-home, very hard for them to manage that. But the more important thing is it's kind of against the grain. I mean, if you think about what we're doing in a digital economy, people are moving more and more to simplified pricing. Now, that's sort of my telecom example. When we first did mobile phones, people did, you know, weekend pricing, time of use pricing, nighttime pricing. Now, you know, the new models is you lease a phone, you get a fixed price, you keep it for 2 years, you return it, you get the new phone, and it's just easy. Netflix pricing, it's subscription pricing, it's not price per movie. And so that's the way people are thinking. And the issue for us in this industry is how do we take that kind of platform thinking and apply it so that it's easy for people to understand what they want and they feel like they're getting value. Because again, if the big power system can't make end users feel like they're getting value for their energy dollar, they'll find ways to get off that big power system. And I don't think that's always a necessarily good thing, but it's our job to internalize the complexity and make it easier for the end user to get value for what they're looking to get.
Another question down the back.
Good morning, Louis Kent from BHP. There's been a lot of discussion this morning about the rapid rate of change and what could be achieved if regulatory settings were different. This rapid rate of change that we're all seeing has been happening under a coalition federal government. If there's a change of government at the next election and the decarbonisation ambition lifts from 26 to 28% by 2030 to 45% by 2030, and you'd assume that the electricity industry would be decarbonising more rapidly, how confident are you that the industry is ready for it? What sort of challenges, opportunities, how do you see that playing out?
Well, you know, I mean, one of the things that we do in at AEMO, particularly in the NEM under our integrated system planning, is we do a scenario analysis. And so we actually model various ramp rates for change and then from there identify the near-term steps that we need to take in order to make sure that whatever the ramp rate is, that we can adjust to meet it. I think that's, you know, that kind of scenario thinking, which I know BHP is sort of excellent at, is what we have to do in this industry. We have to be prepared for any potential eventuality and move to it. The other thing we're doing is that we're doing a study under Alex Monhaus, who's here somewhere, his team is looking at a study which we'll be doing for both the NEM and the WEM to really look at the technical potential of renewables, understand the implications of high level of variable energy, what are we going to need to do technically to absorb it, and then be able to advise governments much in a much more informed way on how what we can accomplish when, because we are different. I mean, a lot of people, as you probably hear too, you know, will talk to me and say, well, this is what they're doing in Germany, and this is what they're doing in Spain, and this is what they're doing in California. You know, and I used to say, yeah, well, I kind of, in New York, we could do a lot of things. But one of the things we had in New York was we had an interconnection that had 150,000 megawatts of generation. So if I had a generator go down, I had this big battery to the north we called Canada that could import down and to serve our needs. And so in an island type of electric island, and we really have just two big electric islands, the Swiss and the NEM, we have to think about, well, how are we going to do this, because it all has to be internal. It can't be imported. And so it just requires that planned thinking and a very good relationship between ourselves and governments and a sense of trust, which gets back to my point around transparency. If we could show people, we could tell people, and they understand that as an independent operator, we're not playing our own book. we're just looking to make sure how to make it occur in the best way for consumers. Then I think we can use engineering science, which is really critical, to help inform governments, and that's really how we'll manage the transformation.
Any other questions? I've just got one. You showed us the slide with the potential duck curve effect, the deep duck, I think you called it. I'm wondering what role could demand management play in trying to alleviate some of the duck?
Oh, I think it precisely. I think the issue is how we're going to solve things at the edge of the system. So how can we use demand management? How can we use intelligence in the networks? How can we use storage so that we can allow people to have as much as they want? And the other thing that, you know, we have to be thinking about this industry now, it's not just about stationary power use. With the onset of electric vehicles, we're going to see this merger of transportation and the electric system. And so the question is, how do we turn what otherwise could be a problem into a solution, and how do we use electric vehicle charging to our advantage as opposed to thinking about it as a threat? So that's why, again, I'm going to keep coming back, this DER roadmap is going to be essential, because that's what it's all, in my mind, it's all about. How do we think about that this is happening, and how do we make it occur in a way that's beneficial for consumers in all ways, both the people who put rooftop solar on the roofs and the people who didn't, because they'll get the advantage of a lower-cost energy system.
One more question down the back.
Hello, Sam Wilkinson here from Curtin University. You talked about one of the key issues was political leadership, but for politicians to make decisions around consumers who are now generating most or a lot of the electricity, how do you de-risk the decision-making processes for politicians when consumers are now going to be generating a lot of the electricity, whereas previously we had tens of generators on the network and now we'll have millions of generators on the network? How do you sort of allow those people with rooftop solar to interact with the network?
So the greatest thing that we can do is this idea of creating a two-way system. So the fundamentals for AMO is we manage a power system where supply and demand has to equal out all the time. And what we want to do is use the sources that are lowest cost. And if that lowest cost sources are demand-based resources, that we could use to take load off the system, we would want to pay for that or compensate that the same way as we would compensate supply. So the idea of a DER roadmap to me is creating a two-way market where consumers who are able to really respond, and I don't mean that they're going to respond themselves, but it's prices to devices or through aggregators, respond and help us manage demand so it's efficient, get it in either form of a credit on their bill, a payment, whatever means that we decide on the regulatory means to do it, but it actually is creating that two-way system. So that's one way. But I think fundamentally what's changing, and when I was 28, 30 years old, and I was a lawyer, and I was representing a utility, and I was explaining to a legislature why some policy that he was doing to help his constituency was going to hurt my company, he looked at me and he said, "But you don't understand. Utilities don't vote. People vote." And I think actually keeping people at the center and recognizing that markets are around the benefit to consumers, not the benefits of market players, is where there's going to be a great deal of alignment of really what the advantages of technology can do, because with good policy, it allows us to conserve consumers better. And now we have this alignment, because if I can get consumers engaged, even if through smart prices to devices and things like that, it'll also make the system more secure, more resilient, and cheaper. So we have a perfect opportunity. We just need to go for it.
Thank you very much, Audrey. That wraps up the question time. I have no doubt that in this room we're all aware of the challenges that are awake for us. And in many ways, I don't envy you trying to navigate all that. But at the same time, it makes it interesting. So thank you. Paula, please.